Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to our afternoon session of Hegemonic Narratives, a conference that we've been running today since 9:30, looking at different levels of where hegemonic narratives and the memory of politics are being used and abused and misused. The third panel we have prepared for you this afternoon is looking at the local level, at the grassroots level. And let me first introduce the moderator of this panel, who will then introduce the speakers, and after which we're going to have our keynote speaker, and then we will wrap up. So the conference is pretty much at the end, not yet though, and we only have about an hour and a half to go. So I hope you're still with us and you're still able to follow us. Please don't forget to ask questions in the Q&A, at the end of the conference, we will again enable the chat function. So let me introduce Dr. Catherine Bachleitner, who's an IKEA research fellow in international relations at Lady Margaret Hall. And her research mainly focuses on collective identity, memory, and values within international relations. She's just submitted a book manuscript, so watch out this space. It should be coming out very soon. It's with Oxford University Press or Cambridge University Press. No, I'm not entirely sure. But anyway, Catherine, the floor is yours. Good luck with the panel.
Okay, so hello everyone and welcome to panel three. From the morning sessions, the question remained as to when and how hegemonic narratives actually become hegemonic. Several presenters already hinted at the fact that an elitist political construction of memory is not enough. Instead, for memory to become truly hegemonic, it must somehow begin to resonate more broadly with the people. In this last panel, we are therefore moving our attention to the grassroots and local level and ask how societal actors can shape and challenge national narratives from below. Now we have three speakers lined up who will cover three different regions. First, Latin America, then we move to Europe, and last but not least, to Africa. Each of the presentations will take 12 minutes, and afterwards there'll be 20 minutes reserved for questions and answers. If you have any queries, please write them in the Q&A box and I will do my best to bring them to the attention of the speakers. We are starting with Andresa de Souza Santos, who is lecturer and director of the Brazilian Studies Program at Oxford University's Latin American Center. Andresa is a political anthropologist. In her research, she specifically looks at heritage policymaking and grassroots activism in cities. In 2019, she published a monograph on the politics of memory, urban cultural heritage in Brazil. And today, Andresa will talk about how narratives of slavery are recounted in Brazil's former gold mines.
Thank you very much for the invitation. I'm very pleased to be here. I will share my screen with you to show my PowerPoint. Please let me know if you already can see my screen. Can you see it?
Yep.
Very good. So I'm gonna be talking about some inconvenient narratives, such as how slavery is remembered in Brazil, how it's, how narratives about slavery appear. And I'm gonna be reading my paper, so if I'm slightly looking to the side, please don't worry. Silence and euphemisms concerning race prevail in Brazil. And the same silence exists in historic depictions of slavery. And slavery in Brazil is thus mainly represented through a recollection of torture objects. And very rarely we have any biographic accounts or monuments on former slaves. And here in the picture of my first slide, you can see some of these torture objects, which are usually portrayed when you go to museums. However, there is, of course, the idea that there are different forms of remembering. And this paper will look at the ways in which slavery is remembered through spiritual narratives in former gold mines. In the former gold mines of Ouro Preto, Brazil, and I'm going to explain a little bit about this city, the descendants of slaves, they usually work as tour guides, and they tell the history of slavery by emphasizing the presence of slave spirits. Slave spirits manifest themselves physically when visitors or guides describe physical pain or accidents in minds. Memories of slavery enacted in narratives about spirits thus constitute a sort of power shift where former oppressed groups active control after death, which they did not have when alive. So one of the questions I try to answer with this paper is, can this power of the excluded who now controls the mining setting go beyond the mining territories? Do people actually visit mines? And what is the potential and the limits of this off-the-record historical narratives? So I now, this is one of the mines. In many countries around the world, the success of cultural heritage narratives in creating a sense of national identity is built in the construction of a common enemy. In post-colonial societies, this sentiment against oppressed or colonized was particularly strong in forging a national identity. In post-colonial Brazil, there were many former slaves, Europeans, Brazilian mixed race, and indigenous groups. And the focus on a common enemy, the colonizers, had much to offer in the search of a Brazilian identity. So there is this construction of a Brazilianness that played down ethnic complexities and generated a simplification of history on a polarization between us, Brazilians, which was a very heterogeneous group, and they, the colonizers. This dualism was very much based and created monuments on independence struggles. And the city of Ouro Preto is particularly important on that. So here you have one of the heroes of Brazil's independence movement. His name is Tiradentes. And there are statues to celebrate Tiradentes and Minas Gerais conspiracy, which was one of the plots against the Portuguese, all over the city. The city is a UNESCO World Heritage Site since the 1980s. And you see monuments and street names and everywhere in the city, this celebration of independence movements. These independence movements, of course, create a sense of Brazilians, which doesn't really go into the complexities of the slaves who made up 80% of the population. But of course, they challenged this national identity because they would form a very heterogeneous group in culture, language, and place of birth. So how is slavery remembering historic sites such as Ouro Preto, which is so important for a Brazilian national identity? So in places like Ouro Preto, slavery is mainly remembered through this recollection of torture objects that are very, as I said, there are no monuments for slaves. And this, because of this, this gap in the representation of slavery, then these spiritual accounts in former gold mines, they try to fill this gap. So let's go and see how the people are telling this story that is very little represented in the city. So when you go to former gold mines, the guides will tell the history of slavery by presenting you to the slave spirits. And I'm just gonna narrate how some of these encounters take place. Just reading here. November 25, 2013. A rain persisted all morning before we arrived at the first gold mine. Big J guided me through the dark, cold, and wet mine, greeted my tour guide, and before we started the tour, he was already telling me that I would need to crouch in the narrow and low corridors. He would say, imagine that time went back by 200 years and you were a 20-year-old man, black man working mines and very poor. Big J, who was the guide, insisted that I should imagine I was a slave to release all my fears. As we walked through the mine, my guide stopped walking and I had to go through the mine, which was this very narrow, small space, alone. As I kept walking, it was dark and humid, and I could still hear the voices of the guides, though they were more distant, and they would say that I need to understand what slaves went through back in those days. The ceiling was getting lower and lower as I walked, and I had to squat in a very uncomfortable and claustrophobic position. And I wondered if it was still possible to move forward or how I would move backwards when my tour guide yelled, "Can you imagine if I would leave and you'd have to stay in the mine for 3 days?" Of course, I could not imagine that, so I tried to move back. But they started to hammer against the wall, producing a very sharp and repetitive sound. And they said, "Men died from this noise. And they got blind when the particles would reach their eyes. Whether others would have their lungs turned into stone when breathing the powder day after day. And the noise continued for a short while when it became very irritating. And at which time I tried to return and I fell because it was very slippery." So the history of slavery in the mines is represented through the recreation of earlier working conditions, including sounds, sights, and sensations. Experience humidity, darkness, noise, and the claustrophobic feeling, the low and narrow corridors in the mines, hopes to illustrate how the slaves lived back in the 18th century. While stories of violence against slaves are told in mines, Rutan points out that there are also paradoxical colonial attributions of power, and the same people who were enslaved, whipped, and chained were also believed to have the power of sorcery. In Ouro Preto, the power of slaves as sorcerers is also very common in local stories, but this power did not end with the sorcery in the past, because nowadays these spirits of slaves, rather than those of mine owners, they dominate mining territories, and they may allow the entrance to mines, or they may not. As some other guides explained to me, you need to be approved by the spirit of the people there, otherwise you do not enter the mine. There are people who arrive here, and they ask me to enter the mines, but when I arrive at the entrance, I fall down. They beat me up, throw me on the floor. With that person, you do not enter. But when the person has a clear soul, mysticism and sensibility that match their and mine, then we can enter the mine. The people there are the spirits of the slaves. And when they do not want a sightseer to enter the mine, they beat the person up, making the visitor or the guide fall down or hit their heads against the ceiling and the walls and inflict headaches after visits. Those are seen as typical signs that the spirits had not granted permission to enter. Local stories involving spiritual infliction of pain in mines are so common that guides report offering tours for people across the world and Brazil, while the local population is usually afraid of mines and do not always visit them. Candles are a visual expression of reports about physical pain caused by spirits. And there are many candles sometimes in the mines to avoid seeing figures and being hunted by some of the spirits. And in mines, you can also see and hear the revealing, I'm about to finish, some of the revealing dreams that some guides have. I was gonna narrate here one of these dreams, but I'm running out of time. But usually through these encounters of slave spirits who may inflict pain on people who try to enter the mines, as well as dreams, they are usually filling gaps in the history. For example, why in a population there were 80% of slaves, there were no rebellion? And then usually this answer that everybody asks comes with stories of, maybe the slaves groups were not cohesive, and they talk about conflicts in the past, and these conflicts are very manifest and very vivid in the dreams that people reveal to have had, as well as these spiritual encounters. However, these stories, they try to give this idea of how slavery happened in Ouro Preto in Brazil, since there are very few biographic accounts and very few information on the geological knowledge the spirits or the slaves had, and how their activities were on an everyday lives. These narratives, they still don't move beyond the mining territories. There are very few people visiting mines, and away from the mines, these stories remain very much off the record. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Andresa, for a fascinating snapshot into how inconvenient narratives emerge as counter-narratives on the grassroots level. And now we are moving to a different region, Europe, and we are going to hear from Graham Dawson, who is Professor of Historical Cultural Studies at the School of Humanities, Center for Memory, Narrative and Histories at the University of Brighton. Graham investigates the interrelations between memory, narrative and lived experience, with a particular interest in personal memories. His main focus is on the politics of memory in the Irish peace process and on legacies of the Northern Irish conflict in Ireland and Britain. He is the author of many seminal works, among them Making Peace with the Past, Memory, Trauma, and the Irish Troubles. Today, Graham is going to talk about grassroots oral history and the politics of hegemonic memory in West Belfast.
Thank you, Catherine. Thank you to Jesse and Johanna for inviting me to speak at this conference and for organizing all the hard work you put into organizing this inspirational online gathering. This paper draws from my current research with and on the Ducas Oral History Archive at Falls Community Council in West Belfast. Ducas was established in 1999 to collect oral history interviews on local experiences of the conflict, to develop experiential storytelling as a tool of reconciliation and of conflict resolution, and to promote cross-community dialogue and grassroots agency in addressing legacies of the past that stem from a shared but deeply contested local history. The paper aims to situate Ducas's grassroots memory work, what I call its practice of reparative remembering, in relation to the hegemonic narratives of the Northern Ireland and the British UK states during and after the war, as these play out in the context of ongoing memory wars and conflicts about the unresolved legacies of the war in Northern Ireland. These conflicts center on questions of legitimacy, responsibility, and atonement for the armed violences committed by state, pro-state, and state forces. And I should just say that I've just realized that my focus of this paper has ended up being on how hegemonic narratives work rather than on how they challenge. So apologies for that. The paper's organized in three parts. And I wanted to begin with a very brief contextualization of the archive in relation to the West Belfast interfaces. Ducas works across the interface between the Loyalist British Shankill area and the Irish nationalist areas of the Falls, which you can see here on this sketch map west of the city centre of Belfast. This relationship between the Shankill and the Falls appears in this British Army map from 1972, the Shankill Road, the Falls Road, and here between the orange and the green, we can see the interface between these two areas. These and other interfaces were the location for the start of the war in Belfast on the 14th and 15th of August 1969, when police and loyalists invaded the nationalist areas down these linking streets between the Shankill and the Falls. And West Belfast has remained a central zone in the war thereafter, with one of the highest numbers of casualties and death rates from the conflict. The red line on this early 70s map shows the route of the Cooper Way Peace Line Wall erected during the war, along with other barriers that continue to materialize and reproduce the social and geographical divisions of the area. Now, Ducas's projects, its original aim, and the first project in 2001, focused on the collective experience of the nationalist communities of the Falls, in August 1969, and this widened out to a broader historical inquiry. But since 2010, Dukas has done oral history work across the interfaces through connections with loyalist community groups in the Shankill and elsewhere in the city, leading to several oral history collections, all of which are deposited in the archive through this cross-community work. Dukas's work is based on principles of informed consent, plurality, acknowledgement and respect of differences, and it aims to create conversations, both public and private, about history and memory between local actors who are, who are differently placed historically in relation to the British state. Now, turning to my second section, the question of hegemonic narratives, I wanted to start, I mean, there's a whole set of caveats which could be unpicked at this point, but Northern Ireland has got no history of a successful hegemonic project bringing consent to state power or bringing social cohesion. At the reformation of the UK state through the partition of Ireland in 1921, an Irish nationalist minority giving allegiance to the government of the Irish Free State in Dublin was forced into the six-county unionist statelets of Northern Ireland within the UK. From its inception, the Northern Ireland state treated its nationalist minority as an enemy within, requiring exceptional but permanent repressive containment by an armed police force, including the feared B Special Police Militia, on the basis of the 1922 Special Powers Act. And this supported devolved governments in what was effectively a one-party state ruled by the Ulster Unionist Party up until 1972, when devolution was suspended and direct rule of Northern Ireland from London was imposed by the British state. The breakdown of Unionist state control in 1968-69 led to the Northern Ireland War, in which from 1971, Unionist and British power came to be challenged by the emergence of a new resurgent Irish Republican Army, the IRA, the Provisional IRA, supported by a revolutionary Republican movement that refused to acknowledge the authority of the UK state. Now, if we understand hegemonic narratives then as those that work to secure public legitimacy for the purposes and the actions of state institutions and operatives, a legitimating narrative, a narrative justifying the measures used in repressive containment of Northern Irish nationalist communities in terms of law and order versus the Republican terrorist threat to the state, can be traced throughout its history and well into the peace process beginning in 1993-94. So my focus here is on the deployment of this hegemonic narrative at the very start of the conflict, at one particular moment in 1969, and its effects on the formations of conflict memory. And I'm only going to be able really to explore the loyalist dimension of that memory rather than, as I'd hoped, the nationalist counter memory. So please bear that in mind. Now, the war in West Belfast began on the 14th, 15th of August, 1969, with a pogrom against Irish nationalist communities, which was led by state forces. An armed invasion, the word of the official government inquiry, of the nationalist falls from the Shankill was fronted by the Royal Ulster Constabulary using armoured vehicles armed with machine guns. Police and members of the B Specials militia, heavily armed, including with submachine guns and high velocity rifles, worked with loyalist mobs organised by the paramilitary Shankill Defence Association, who were also heavily armed with guns and hundreds of petrol bombs. This overwhelming and deadly force was deployed against an unarmed civilian population, shooting nationalists in the street and in their own homes, burning hundreds of nationalist houses and properties, expelling thousands of people from their homes, injuring hundreds, and causing terror and mayhem. State discourse from unionist politicians and the police responded to this crisis as a threat to law and order by Republicans. At the official public inquiry into the events under Lord Scarman, the police testified, all RUC ranks testifying at Scarman, maintained that they faced an IRA uprising. This justification was echoed by Belfast's police commissioner, who also admitted under testimony that loyalist violence, quote, was one of the sort of blind spots that the IEC have, that the IEC have, given that, quote, the training of the force from its inception in 1921 had always been against what we call the subversive element, the IRA, and so on. Yet, the IEC Deputy Commissioner, in his testimony to the Scarman Inquiry, acknowledged that, quote, no IRA attack took place anywhere in Belfast. That's not actually a quote from the Deputy Commissioner. It's a quote from McCann's history. But in reality, the IRA in Belfast in 1969 was defunct. The report of the Scarman Inquiry endorsed the justificatory narrative, the legitimating narrative, of the state, of the police, and reproduced its imaginings, in its denials and its silences. And the report largely excused the IUC and the B specials, and absolving the police of any significant involvement in the invasion. And in doing so, it upheld the reputation of state institutions and actors as moral agents of law and order, and installed a hegemonic official narrative and memory about the start of the war that obscured the reality of state violence in precipitating it. Now, this officially endorsed framework of meaning also enabled the consolidation of a key narrative in the memory culture of Belfast loyalist communities, that the so-called riots of August 1969 were instigated by the IRA, to which loyalist paramilitary groups were reactive and defensive. In fact, anticipatory fears of an impending Republican assault had been systematically provoked since April 1969 by the Loyalist Paramilitary Shankill Defence Association, the SDA, that warned against imminent attacks from the Falls Road and used these unfounded rumours to canvass support for organisations set up to defend Protestant localities from these imagined Republican incursions. Sarah Nelson, in her book Ulster's Uncertain Defenders, identifies a widespread belief among Ulster Protestants that the riots were part of a coordinated attack by Catholics on Protestants, and describes this as one example of what she calls community myths about August 1969, there's echoes here of John Aldous's paper this morning. But according to Nelson, the existence of such myths points to the, quote, considerable difficulty experienced by most Protestants in coming to terms with what Nelson calls the extra-legal violence committed by loyalists and the police. Community myths provided a common sense and unquestioned framework of local understanding for people in loyalist areas, quote from Nelson, which kept their self-image intact as loyal and law-abiding people, end of quote, and enabled them to make sense of the upheavals and the violence that was erupting around them. Community myths of the community coming under attack in 1969 and loyalist paramilitaries as defenders rather than as primary aggressors were absorbed into local loyalist popular memory. So if in the final section of the talk, briefly, we turn to the oral histories in Ducasse, we can find Nelson's community myths surfacing in interviews with Protestants who were parents and children in 1969, interviews that were collected by Ducasse's partner organisations in the Shankill in the projects conducted between 2012 and 14. In these interviews, one strand of memory concerns the shock of seeing that the Catholics were getting put out of their houses. The houses were burning. People were taking their furniture out of their houses, houses on fire. But another strand of memory is of the fear, quote, when we were told the Catholics were coming to put us out, that spurred some families to evacuate for a few days to other parts of the city. And in one interview, an individual remembers being in bed and the B specials rapped at our door at about 6:30 in the morning to tell us that the Catholics were coming from Ballymurphy to put us out, that there were hundreds coming from Ballymurphy to put the Protestants out. Now, the imaginary character of this provoked fear of an IRA assault on the Shankill from nationalist Ballymurphy is clear from Kieran de Barra's history, Ballymurphy and the Irish War. Ballymurphy is a nationalist housing estate further west on the interface, which had a reputation as a bad estate with social problems. It was also fierce and also Republican. But on the 14th and the 15th of August, 1969, the reality, according to de Barrode, was, who was a community organizer working inside that community throughout the conflict, when barricades were erected around the Ballymurphy estate in protection against any attempted invasion from the neighboring loyalist areas, three shotguns were acquired for defense. And these were sent running from barricade to barricade to make much of the display of the weapons so as to bluff their neighbors into believing Ballymurphy to be an armed fortress. Clearly Ballymurphy was in no position to invade the Shankill, but nevertheless, the structure of feeling crystallized in these groundless memories from the Shankill in 1969 of being under attack from the Catholics, or under the threat of attack from the Catholics of Ballymurphy, persists in a long emotional afterlife and underpins understandings over 40 years later in oral history interviews that we, the Protestant people, were getting it really bad, that the Catholics were doing the bombing and the shooting and they were getting away with it. Now, in conclusion then, I'd like to point to the way the work of transforming relations and developing new historical dialogues across divisions at grassroots level is shaped and constrained by the reproduction of hegemonic narratives from conflict times that have embedded in local memory cultures. In Dukas Shankill interviews, memories of intimate, personal and familial responses to the outbreaks of the war also carry narratives derived from state-sponsored justifications and from locally formed community myths into the era of reconciliation and the shared future. And comparable, though not identical, lacuna can also be traced in nationalist and republican memories, perhaps especially about the devastating impact on loyalist communities when a resurgent IRA campaign did indeed begin in 1971 and began bombing pubs and other civilian targets in the Shankill. Grassroots and cross-community memory work, like that of the Dukas Oral History Archive, faces the difficulty of negotiating the resulting imaginings, denials, and silences that necessarily enter into those conversations that it promotes across the interface. And I want to end with the reflection that transformative moments at this local grassroots level, transformative movement at this local grassroots level, is bound up with the politics of winning necessary narrative shifts and acknowledgements by state and non-state actors within the wider public arena of legacy politics centered on matters of truth and justice. At the moment, the prospects for this in relation to the Northern Ireland war are not good, but on the other hand, they are not without hope. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you, Bram. And now, last but not least, we have our very own Jocelyn Alexander, Professor of Commonwealth Studies at the Department of International Development. Jocelyn works on social and political history in Southern Africa and is particularly interested in liberation struggles and their legacies. She co-authored the book Violence and Memory and is the author of The Unsettled Land, The Politics of Land and State Making in Zimbabwe. And today, Jocelyn will talk about the memory of violent repression in Zimbabwe.
Thank you very much. Hi, everyone. I'm going to be very unfashionable and not have a PowerPoint presentation, so I apologize because you're going to have to just look at my face through the whole thing. I want to start just by thanking Jesse, Johanna, and Catherine as well for starting the organization of this day when we lived in a different world and keeping it going in this much altered one. I mean, really well done. That can't have been easy. So my presentation focuses on local memory making processes and actors in Matabeleland, Zimbabwe, focusing on state violence in the years after independence in 1980. I've written about this history of violence for many years, but my interest was recently piqued anew, owing to a boom in what we might call mnemonic activity that sat alongside a widespread claim that this history was silenced. So it's this seeming paradox of what I'm calling noisy silence that I want to explore. I'm going to start with a few words about the 80s violence, because I think probably not everyone is familiar with it. Okay, so this period of violent repression is known as Gukuruhundi, and it took place immediately after independence, following a lengthy armed liberation struggle. It was rooted in the unresolved tensions of that struggle, in which not one but two nationalist movements had fought. The victor in 1980 was ZANU-PF, the party that rules Zimbabwe up to today. ZANU-PF used the new country's security forces to target its nationalist counterpart, ZAPU, with the intent of eliminating it as a political rival. And in that aim, it succeeded. In 1987, ZAPU was absorbed into ZANU-PF under the so-called Unity Accord and ceased to exist. The ZANU-PF government's violent repression focused on the western regions of the country, notably Matabeleland, where ZAPU was strongest. It was carried out by state agents, most egregiously the newly formed 5th Brigade of the National Army. The official narrative of Gukuruhundi, at its simplest, is that government forces were hunting dissidents from ZAPU's armed wing, who were, along with their leaders, seeking to overthrow the new government. But this story can't explain the nature of the violence in which an estimated 10,000 civilians were killed and thousands more were detained, tortured, starved, and disappeared by the intelligence services, police, and paramilitaries. The target constituted by ZAPU and its armed wing was also rapidly blurred in political discourse and practice to include all members of the minority ethnic group that inhabited this region, the Ndebele, and the majority, kind of the biggest group in Zimbabwe is the Shona. So this had the effect of giving Gukuruhundi cultural, historical, and linguistic weight. And one of its legacies was the making of a very politicized Ndebele identity. I think I should just stay right at the beginning really clearly that this, the official narrative of Gukuruhundi has never been hegemonic in this region. This region has had many of its own stories, and you could say their stories, though contradictory and disputed, have always been hegemonic. The local has always been hegemonic. Okay, so that's a few sentences on Gukuruhundi as an event. And let me now turn to the kind of local noise around it in recent years. So more than three decades after the signing of the Unity Accord and the end of violence, a conviction that this violent history is silenced pervades the Matabeleland provinces. So the claim of silence comes from young political activists, journalists in the independent media, civic leaders based in the region's capital city, Bulawayo, rural traditional leaders, members of a larger diaspora, and a great penumbra of people on social media, you know, of course. So it would be foolish to suggest that acts of silencing don't have a very real element to them. Fear has always been attached to speaking out about Gukuruhundi. Many of those who have done so have suffered violence, threats, and spurious prosecution in courts. There's nonetheless an unstable space in which noise can be made, and it has grown and changed in two recent moments of transition. One, a short-lived unity government that incorporated a new opposition movement alongside ZANU-PF between 2009 and 2013. And the second, following the political rupture created by the November 2017 coup. So that coup brought down ZANU-PF's iconic leader, Robert Mugabe, the man who had directed Gukuruhundi. He was, however, replaced by his erstwhile henchman of that and later periods, Emmerson Mnangagwa. So for Matabeleland, this was an ambiguous transition because it left the Gukuruhundi perpetrators in power. Nonetheless, the widely touted promise of a new dispensation provoked an outpouring of Gukuruhundi talk. So this outpouring has taken many forms, in part because there's never been any kind of formal redress. So the frames of law or reconciliation or truth are not dominant, though they are pervasive. There's no single counter-narrative, but a looser telling of stories across a variety of genres and media. So these treatments of Gukuruhundi appeared in Zimbabwean authored novels and in plays, some staged in Zimbabwe, others in South Africa, in histories, some of them biographies, written and published in Bulawayo, and in substantial new academic studies, many by Zimbabwean academics, often based again in South Africa. They appeared in contested memorial making processes and in paintings. The artist Owen Maseko held a major exhibition of paintings depicting the violence of Gugurahindi at the Bulawayo National Gallery in 2010, and that's a state institution, though it was rapidly shut down and Maseko was taken to court on public order charges. Two major documentaries by the Bulawayo-based journalist and filmmaker Zenzele Ndebele also appeared, one in 2008 and one in 2018. Both brought harassment and threats, but both were publicly screened in Bulawayo. Ndebele has also established a Gugurahindi library, and Maseko is actually establishing a Gugurahindi theme park. There are many kind of, there's a kind of big video collection of accounts of Gugurahindi survivors. So the showing of Ndebele's 2018 film was in part made possible by the attendance at its launch of members of a post-coup institution, the National Peace and Reconciliation Commission, or NPRC. This was Zimbabwe's first attempt at something like a truth commission. The NPRC's independence is deeply compromised, and it has been controversial in Matabeleland, but it has acted as a kind of new vector for public debate and action, including the exhumation of a handful of mass graves from the 80s. The NPRC has also held meetings in Matabeleland that attracted protest, notably from the young men of the Umtwakazi Republic Party, a separatist political organization that has put Gugurahindi at its center. The party derailed meetings by dancing, singing, and waving banners, calling for justice, denouncing President Mnangagwa, and condemning the Shona speaking and our NPRC commissioners. The history of Gugurahindi was also raised again and again in the context of semi-public and public events, from the funerals of ZAPU luminaries to the remaking of the public holiday that marks the Unity Accord as Gugurahindi Day, complete with marches, songs, and banners adorned with the faces and stories of victims in central Bulawayo. So all this social media attention as well. That's a kind of sense of the noise. So where does the sense of silence come from? So I draw on the idea of recognition to explain the experience of silence amidst noise. Silence doesn't mean a failure to tell or to know, but a failure on the part of particular audiences to engage and to hear. Most importantly, in this case, perpetrators who are still in power. So this specific failure of recognition has not meant that there's no recognition at all, but rather that it's circumscribed in ways that have consequences, both for what we might call communities of hearing and for strategies of telling. So themes running through much of the literature on the legacies of violent pasts, to simplify hugely, is that acts of silence create buried memories that are corrosive of political and social relations, while truth-telling and the act of sharing stories is restorative and healing. So this telling and sharing returns agency and humanity to individuals by spanning the private and public spheres and affirming collective ideals. And it's this move that's been glossed as recognition. So as is widely noted again, there are many obstacles to this act of recognition. In brief, stories of violence may fail to achieve recognition by remaining untold, unheard, unbelieved, or unsayable. Work on soldiers or on victims of sexual violence, for example, have explored these outcomes, as have studies of truth commissions that identify the constraints put on the stories that can be told within them. So if truth commissions can themselves silence and leave narratives unheard, what happens to recognition where perpetrators are still in power? So one outcome is that people and groups explore an awkward middle ground between private and public, seeking recognition from authorities and collectives, communities of hearing, short of the state. And these have different purposes and different effects. So exhumations have come to play a complex role in creating substantial local forms of recognition that do not seek to engage perpetrators. So one of the post-coup exhumations involved a reburial of a man called Julius Ndlovu, who was tortured and shot by the 5th Brigade in 1983. It brought together his extended family, some of whom had not seen each other since the day of his murder, along with a range of church and community leaders. The exhumation and funeral involved telling of Julius's life and of his death, through testimony, social ritual, and forensic science, which acted to remake the bonds and memories across this family in a newly kind of noisy form. The perpetrators, as falsifiers and deniers, were not entirely absent, however. The cause of death on Julia's state-issued death certificate was listed as headache. The family fought and failed to have it changed. Their sense of a story still truncated is palpable, as is their alienation as citizens. The desire to document in order to challenge state denial lies behind the work of the documentary makers Zanzelli and Nobelli, who I mentioned just now. His work collects evidence largely through witness testimony, and it also deliberately seeks a reaction from the state through public performance. So his community of hearing includes the victims of Gukuruhundi, but his strategy of telling is aimed at the perpetrators, and this has shaped how he has told his story. First and foremost, as a string of extreme atrocities, the number of which is increased in each telling. And secondarily, as a political history of the betrayal of one nationalist movement by another, i.e. ZANU-PF. A younger generation who did not themselves experience the violence of the 80s have told Gukuruhundi stories in yet another form in protest and social media. And here I have to say I enjoyed very much the Charles's paper on, or is it, sorry, I'm probably getting your name wrong now, but the paper on Lebanon around youth. And this is another kind of case of intergenerational activity. So I'm drawing here on the work of Lena Rhein on the angry youthful members of the Umtwakazi Republic Party. And she argues that this generation didn't learn about the past through unburying the memories of their parents, but produced their own version to make sense of the present. This was shaped as a reaction to official narratives of Gukuruhundi and to their experience of extreme economic and political marginalization. The past they unburied put to the side the story of the crushing of ZAPU in favor of Gukuruhundi as an ethnic genocide perpetrated by the majority Shona against the Ndebele. So in this account, the 80s violence was simply one step in an ongoing effort to destroy the Ndebele. Shonas as a collective were cast as both the perpetrators of the 80s and the beneficiaries of the present. The political endpoint of the Umtwakazi's story is a rejection of the nation of Zimbabwe in favor of an idealized version of a pre-colonial Ndebele state. Okay, so I'm concluding now. In the gray area between public and private, where recognition can only be partially given, it still matters, and it still plays a central role in making memories that do not belong to the perpetrator state, and that can bring together communities of hearing, if not necessarily of healing. The incomplete recognition on offer can also produce an alienating politics on one hand, and a divisive hyperbolic politics on the other, both of which create profound obstacles to mutual recognition across a host of different lines, generational, political, and ethnic. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jocelyn. I really like this image, or better, sound of noisy silence that you provided us with. I think it captures really well the paradoxes that surround traumatic memory in all different post-conflict scenarios. Mm-hmm. And now, I've gathered some questions. First, I will start with Graham. So Graham, Jasna asks you, can you tell us something about the contestation of hegemonic memory from within the loyalist camp, or do counter-memory narratives only come from the nationalists? And then connected to this is also a question, have these narratives traveled or migrated south of the border or across the Irish Sea?
Thank you for these questions. I've tried to refer to answer them in the chat, in the question and answer, actually, rather than thinking that was the thing we were doing here, rather than paying full attention to Jocelyn's paper. But thanks for the question, Jasna. You're right. There is no homogenous unity to loyalist popular memory. So I've really emphasized the connections running through in my paper to try and draw out the ways in which hegemonic narratives become embedded within oral history interviews. But within the Ducasse archive, you'd find many, many examples of much more, you know, a much wider range of memories, a much wider range of nuanced responses to the history. And the sense of how the diversity and complexity of those grassroots memories play out and become visible, I think, is one of the things that's really interesting for the project for Ducas. How to get underneath, as it were, some of the big public, political, collective memories that are still being articulated. And, you know, we saw John putting up some of the murals, for example, you know, in his talk this morning. But how to get underneath that to the complexity and the range. And I think that we're at a very early stage of being able to understand and give voice to that range. Contestation certainly has focused on the role of loyalist paramilitaries, and also actually on the role of the British Army. But many Protestants, Unionist Loyalists, never supported and were hostile to loyalist paramilitary action, but wanted to affirm this narrative of law and order. And it's a very powerful, I'd say, and very deeply rooted narrative that wants to emphasize the sense of the difference between the forces of law and order, you know, and legitimate violence versus the illegitimate terrorist violence of the other. And I think that the other thing I'd say about the Schenker would be that that there is also a kind of bringing together across this range of differences, a tendency to crystallize around the victimhood of the community, the suffering and the pain of the community at the hands of the real violence committed by the IRA after 1971. So that would be, I hope that answers partly the question. I'd say partly that the hegemonic memory remains in place, but it's fractured, and it's under the peace process and the narrative of reconciliation, it's opened up to a whole range of nuances and inflections that we need to understand more about.
We have one more question to Andresa, although I think it might also be interesting for you, Jocelyn. So the question is, why did this dualism between Brazilians and colonizers appear in Brazilian identity construction rather than in other dominant colonial settler identities, like in South Africa, Kenya, Zimbabwe, where intergenerational identity was constructed as Europeans in Africa?
Yeah, I really like that question. And let's see what was the case in Jocelyn's study. But in Brazil, it was very important to, like, Brazil created this racial democracy where, because it had so many subgroups of mixed Brazilian born Europeans that were living in Brazil, all the variety of indigenous groups with their many languages and cultures, and of course the former slaves that were brought to Brazil and that had also their many cultures and languages and so on. So Brazil decided to play all that down and create a sense of Brazilianness, which valued the mixture. It wasn't good to be European or Black or Indigenous. It was like as if the best was the best of all these worlds together. And that made being Brazilian good. And Brazil was the sense of mixture. And that what was called the racial democracy that Brazil is famous for. Obviously, that denied a discussion about slavery, about the violence perpetrated and suffered by these groups as well as indigenous groups, but created this sense of what it is to be Brazilian. And then to enhance that, it was also this, what is non-Brazilian? And that was, you know, usually this European colonizer. So that is what happened in independent Brazil, especially Republican Brazil around the 30s, 1930s.
Jocelyn, do you want to add something?
I see that another question has come in that's about Gukuruhundi.
Yeah, would you like to answer that?
I know you're completely out of time again, so maybe I'll just jump on that while it's there.
Yeah, no, we have 4 minutes, so go for it.
Oh, okay. So the question is about during the 2008 election in Zimbabwe and what's happening now, which is another round of fairly repressive politics. Would you say there's been and there is another silent Gukuruhundi going on at the moment? I think that has to be, that's a question you cannot answer globally about Zimbabwe. If you're standing in Bulawayo, you would answer that question one way. If you're standing in Harare, you would answer it another way. And that's partly my point, is that if we're talking about hegemonic narratives here, they're very different in different parts of Zimbabwe. There's no single narrative about Gukuruhundi. So the narrative about Gukuruhundi being repeated today in Bulawayo, which is pervasive, is about Shona colonizing that part of that country and exploiting Ndebele speakers, taking their jobs, taking over their businesses, running the city council, taking over positions as school teachers in the civil service, that range of complaints. Whereas in Harare, Gukuruhundi being reproduced now is also a narrative, but it's about how the techniques of violence used in the 1980s and the perpetrators of violence of the 1980s are continuing to orchestrate oppression today. And that's also, a common line of argument, but it's not the same one as the one in Bulawayo. So I think that is politically significant that those are so distinctive, those two views on what Gukuruhundi is today. Obviously I very much take your point that there are parallels in the forms of repression across the 40 years of Zimbabwean independence.
All right, and thank you very much for three fascinating presentations. And now I am handing back over to Jesse and to another keynote speech.